I'm Lee Camp, and this is your moment of clarity. And I apologize, but today's topic is a little darker than usual. It's spelling. When did we as a nation just give up on spelling? I don't think I was at that meeting. Was there a meeting where everyone goes, you know what? Fuck this. We don't know whether the word misspelling has two S's or five, and we don't have time to care. We don't have time for spelling and grammar and reading and verifying spotty intelligence before bombing other countries. What do I look like, a fucking secretary to you? And I'm not saying I spell everything right. Sometimes when I've had a few drinks and the computer screen's blurry when viewed through one bloodshot eye, I'll throw a couple of extra R's into the word slurring. Sure. And the other day I spelled the activity repelling, like it had to do with scaring people away, rather than what it really has to do with immense wedgies from 1,000 feet up. But I'm not talking about drunk spelling or words we never use. I'm talking about the decision that 70% of our population has made that any word that even fucking sounds like your is spelled Y-O-U-R. Your dog is driving that car, Y-O-U-R. You're going to the swingers party, Y-O-U-R. I wonder what swinger parties were like in the days of yore, Y-O-U-R. You are. What's all over my bedsheets? Urine? Y-O-U-R-N. And we fucking obliterated the words there and definitely. Definitely now has at least 9 widely accepted spellings, all of which seem to contain a wayward letter A. And if you look closely at that letter A, you can see that even it doesn't know what the fuck it's doing there. It looks scared and confused like Elizabeth Hasselbeck on The View. And here's my biggest problem with this. This is not the days of yore when in order to spell a word right, you'd have to grab a big old dictionary and throw it at your slave to get his attention and tell him to ride his horse an hour to the town wordsmith who would consult several scholarly tomes before chiseling the correct spelling into a giant slab of granite that would be delivered back to you. Quite the contrary. There's a little red line under almost every misspelled word we type, screaming at us. It's going, this word right here, it's fucked up. I, a computer, far smarter than you, am almost certain that the word definitely does not have a silent G and an umlaut. Are we just that full of ourselves as a nation that we think the computer couldn't possibly know this shit better than we do? Or does everyone just think the bright red line is the internet's way of saying, great job! I'm going to celebrate your excellent spelling with a flamboyant red boa! Hurrah! And it's one thing if you're misspelling words while sexting or tweeting, or sometimes the Esquire magazine just doesn't have enough big goofy W's to finish out your ransom note. I can sympathize with that. But when people are arguing politics or foreign policy, it kinda affects your fucking argument. Demanding abortion should be illegal should not be done while simultaneously demanding abortion should be spelled with an SH. Or maybe you're taking the pro-choice stance of, it's my word, I can decide what's inside of it. Other countries insist we're ignorant because we don't know other languages, and I can't argue because I can't speak any others, except, of course, for the language of love, which I'm fluent in. But that doesn't help much in Yugoslavia. The road signs are almost never translated into love. I'm just saying, if we're not going to speak other languages, perhaps we should try and speak our own. Anyway, I'm Lee Camp, and that's your moment of clarity. Get more at leecamp.net. Also, I've just launched a 5-minute podcast version of Moment of Clarity. It has the rant that you just heard, along with some bonus stuff that you can check out. And you can get that by going to the web address that's likely right underneath my chin right now. Thanks. I'm Lee Camp, and that's your moment of clarity. Get more of these at leecamp.net.
And that was Lee Camp, the greatest challenge facing the United States. And for when you're sick of thoughtless fart jokes, fear-mongering, and people trying to dumb you down, this is Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast episode number 119. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. This episode is an interview with Scott Onstott, titled The Quadrivium and Sacred Architecture, and is being released on Wednesday, July 13, 2011. My interview with Scott was recorded on July 13, 2011. Scott Onstott went to college at UC Berkeley and graduated with a bachelor's degree in architecture in 1992. He began his career doing manual drafting and soon transitioned to AutoCAD and gained experience in several prominent engineering, architecture, and interior firms in San Francisco. Scott worked as a draftsman, CAD designer, job captain, animator, and programmer before becoming an independent consultant. He's taught over 45 semester courses at three Bay Area colleges and has written and edited dozens of technical computer books. Scott is also the maker of the video series Secrets in Plain Sight, an exploration of art, architecture, and urban design, which unveils an unlikely intersection of geometry, politics, numerical philosophy, religious mysticism, new physics, music, astronomy, and world history. And you can find out more about Scott on his website at www.secretsinplainsight.com. And that's plain, P-L-A-I-N, and site, S-I-G-H-T.com. And last week was quite crazy after going on both Joe Rogan and Alex Jones shows back-to-back, and the feedback was very interesting. I received about 600 emails and messages regarding the interviews, and of those, about 550 of them were people complaining about how Alex, and especially Joe, constantly interrupted me. But most also thank me for going on their shows, because otherwise they might not have learned about Gnostic media. And I also heard from about 10 heroin addicts and alcoholics after mentioning Ibogaine research on Joe's show, and they were all sent in the proper direction for treatment, so we may have saved a few lives. That is, when we weren't interrupted. Anyway, I don't know why anyone would want to put their show in such a tiny, restrictive box as Joe has, with such heavy censorship that you have to interrupt like Fox News' Bill O'Reilly whenever a guest says something intelligent. But if you say dick, fuck, pussy, or cunt, all junior high bathroom humor, it's all highly encouraged. But let's not discuss anything that empowers others. And I get the bro talk, but come on, folks, seriously. And I certainly didn't put any restrictions on Joe when he came on my show last year, and he certainly was not our typical academic type guest. And Joe was free to discuss what he liked, uncensored and uninterrupted, without being accused of planking, as was Red Band's appeal to ridicule. And I find it interesting in comparison that for years after I first met Joe, he and I would spend hours on the phone talking about all kinds of different research, in depth on different stuff, and he actually complained publicly on his show that we discussed anything of depth. And I think it's funny that now he plays to the lowest common denominator, which is Red Band, and whatever Red Band can't comprehend, which is to say, anything beyond dick jokes, it gets censored. So, idiocracy, anyone? And when hundreds of people from your own audience send emails complaining about your cutting off and censorship, well, I think that says enough. Regardless, I thank both Joe and Alex for having me on their shows, and, you know, Joe, I do love you, bro, but, man, you gotta fix that censorship crap. And, let's see, transcript. Last week's show, I still need a transcript for Jay Fike's interview, if anyone can help with that. And donations, this week's episode is dedicated to Matt, Lorna, Derek, Anna, Kim, Hans, Jacob, Derek number 2, Paul, Tony, Ron, Steven, Eric, Marco, Brian, and Andre. And also on the Gnostic Media website, there is a widget for donations to help with new computer equipment. The computer that we're using right now for all of the major work is about 3 years old, and certain things are beginning to fail, and it needs to be replaced as soon as possible. And we've had a number of people contribute for that. I will announce all of those who contributed when the thing is finished. But if you could please help, we'd greatly appreciate it. And this show is run on donations and our website sales. This is not corporate media, but independent media in the truest sense of the words. And by donating or ordering one of the books or DVDs or the audio archives or getting a membership, etc., you help to continue this programming. And upcoming shows, hopefully next week, will be Professor Paul Churchland from UC San Diego. I apologize for not having him on already, and we'll be discussing his book, The Engine of Reason and the Seat of the Soul. Also, Dodd Sutton from Wooden Books to discuss Islamic design, and Derek Murphy to discuss his new book, Jesus Potter, Harry Christ, Miguel Connor, Peter Gorman. And you can support this program once again by going to the Gnostic Media website and ordering one of the books or the DVDs or the She Who Remembers audio archives, a membership for the archive downloads, a t-shirt, etc. We greatly appreciate your support. The views expressed by the authors and guests of this unprogram are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself, the host, or Gnostic Media. You can go to Gnostic Media at www.gnosticmedia.com. That's G-N-O-S-T-I-C media.com. You can contact me directly through the form on the website or at contact@gnosticmedia.com. Thank you for listening and thank you for your support. And here is my interview with Scott Onstott. And this goes along with your quadrivium studies. Enjoy. All right, Scott, do you want to start off by telling us a little bit about yourself? Who is Scott Onstott?
Sure. Well, I'm still trying to figure out who that is, too. But, I went to school at UC Berkeley, got a degree in architecture, worked in San Francisco for a number of years in architecture. And I guess I realized after about 6 years that I was more interested in the 3D design software than I was in building corporate interiors. So I started teaching AutoCAD and 3D Studio at different local universities in San Francisco. And I ended up teaching for about 7 years at the Academy of Art University in San Francisco. Taught over 1,000 students there and sort of learned how to become a good teacher. And around that time, I started editing computer books. I ended up editing about 24 software titles, and then I started writing my own. And by now, I've written about 6 computer books, and I'm currently working on one called Photoshop Essentials. So that's sort of my professional side. But what led me to create Secrets in Plain Sight sort of had to do with side interests that I had along the way. I remember back in college, they mentioned something about sacred geometry, and it was just like maybe half a lecture or something. And I just kept that in the back of my mind as something interesting to look into. And eventually I did, and I started drawing, you know, all these sacred geometry things you find in AutoCAD. And I think that was around in the late 90s, and I tuned into crop circles. Right around that time, they were starting to get really interesting. And I was really interested in the designs primarily. So what I would do is I would trace them in AutoCAD and draw them. And it was sort of a meditation for me. And I think just the act of sort of meditating on this sacred geometry was something that really opened my mind and helped me grow in some, you know, sort of mysterious way, I guess. I guess I was just sort of floating along like that for a few years doing that. And then in 2008, I was listening to some interviews on Project Camelot. I was really keenly interested in that. And I came across one interview with Marcia Schaefer. And she's like a clairvoyant or a person who isn't intuitive. And I was really impressed with her interview. She seemed really grounded and down to earth. And so I was intrigued enough to pay for a phone consultation with her. And I think that was in the beginning of 2009. And she talked to me and told me things about myself that were, it was kind of eerie because they were so true. And it's like she knew me super well. And you know, I'd never spoken to her before. And she knew me in ways that you can't really find out just by looking at my website or whatever. So I felt that, you know, there was something to it. And I asked her to communicate with my higher self or spirit guides, which is something that she advertises that she can do. And anyway, right away she said, we have sort of a unanimous a consensus here of all your spirit guides say you're going to become a video producer. And I was kind of blown away because at the time I wasn't really sure, you know, what a video producer's job was about and how I could possibly do that, because I've been making my living now for, I don't know, about, I think about 13, 14 years making screen captured videos, teaching architects and engineers how to use design software primarily. And, you know, I've told her I was looking for something. I wanted to expand. I was kind of feeling stagnant doing that. And she said, yeah, you're going to become a video producer, but she wouldn't tell me or didn't know. I don't know. She didn't know what that video would be about. So after I hung up the phone with her, I was kind of amazed because I felt like this was real information. This was something I needed to pay attention to and to look into it. And so I started brainstorming and writing down like copious notes on all these different things I tuned into. And I've read lots of different interesting books since that original sort of mind opening that I had when I tuned into crop circles. And so after this phone conversation with Marcia Schaefer, I wrote like about 1,000 pages of notes. It was like this download.
What is your opinion, if I may, on crop circles?
Well, I think it's a complex phenomenon, and there's definitely more to it than what the media says, which is that there were these two two older gentlemen who made all the crop circles. And that's impossible because they've been happening all over the world. You know, there's something like 10,000 reported crop circles. And so I think some of them are made by people, but the more interesting ones are the ones that are mysterious, that happened in a 15-minute window and are, you know, some of them are 800 feet across. I think that was the biggest one. Incredible designs. And I think it's one of the most interesting subjects, you know, in the world. And it's amazing to me that so many people just write it off. They just believe that there are these two guys who made it all, and that's enough for them. It's not enough for me. I think the designs are too compelling to dismiss. And so I think that there's some kind of extraordinary author there on a large number of the crop circles. And, you know, I don't have any proof about who that is. But
could possibly be just technology that someone has somewhere that us general masses don't know about.
You know, that could be. The military could certainly have a satellite that beams down these things and fries the crop, you know. But when you start looking into the research of Nancy Talbot, who is a scientist who studies the physical remains in the crop circles, where she looks at these nodes in the corn that are
right,
that, you know, have heated up, and it causes the crop to bend over and fall over, and also some of the crops are swirled. You know, this kind of technology is well beyond what. We have today.
Well, at least for the public, but that doesn't mean that we as humans have. I'm sure there's a lot that we don't know about.
You know, that could be. There could be some black ops budgets who've developed these things. But on the other hand, when you look at some of the designs, I just seriously doubt that people that are really in these black ops projects that have probably not a good intention for people could make such beautiful, harmonious designs. So I more favor the idea that it's, you know, there's extraterrestrials involved or
something. Do we dare, in lack of evidence for ourselves, assume a higher power by default?
Everyone has this is where you have to fill in your own theory. You know, if you believe in God, you could say that God makes them. If you are a fan of the UFO phenomenon, you can say it's UFOs. If you think some future humans have traveled back in time and are making these, or if you.
But how would we derive certainty and truth under this situation, though, rather than just creating various arbitrary things to fill in the void of information? you know, what needs to be done to derive certainty so that we do know exactly what's happening there. That's kind of my point, so that we're removing the contradictions and finding the truth.
Yeah, there's a lot of supposition there at this point, but I think you have to do things like Nancy Talbot is doing at the BLT Research Project, where she's going into the field, collecting samples that are outside the crop circle, used as controls, collecting samples in the circle, looking at all the magnetic anomalies, looking at the little white, mysterious white powders that are found in the field. You know, looking at all the physical evidence is something that she's doing. You know, she doesn't have a very big budget, and we're talking about one researcher there that has a small operation. You know, this really should be something that is studied by scientists and by, you know, with people that have labs and stuff. But unfortunately, the meme is that, you're going to be laughed out of the room if you talk about crop circles or whatever. And I think that's silly. I think that there's too much evidence there to dismiss.
All right, let's get over to your documentary, which is called Secrets in Plain Sight. And you've got a version on YouTube that's broken into 23 parts, and I'll be putting your entire video in one piece up on my channel for this interview. So let's go back over to, and you know what, I find very interesting that you got to this field through architecture, as did John Martineau of Wooden Books, who's published, you know, the Quadrivium book series and all of the smaller wooden books. One of them you even cite in your video here. But I think it's very interesting that both of you who are uncovering all of these secrets in architecture and design and things like that are both coming from the same background.
Well, yeah, architecture is just one of the many ways into these mysteries. And I think architects over the centuries, some of them have been tuned into these things and encoded some of these, what I call secrets in plain sight, into their work. And that's something I've done, is found this sort of occult architecture all over the world and bringing it to your attention in the Secrets in Plain Sight videos.
What is the primary foundation or idea in Secrets in Plain Sight?
Well, it's these patterns that I've found that relate to number and geomancy, and that is the position of monuments on the earth, as well as solar alignments that I've found. And basically it all boils down to the quadrivium. Because I found evidence in each one of the four subjects, number, geometry, music, and astronomy, that are these encoded secrets that are usually in plain sight right there in the middle of one of the world's great cities, just sitting there. But for whatever reason, most people don't perceive it as such. For example, the Washington Monument in Washington, D.C., is 555 feet high, and that just so happens to be equal to 6,660 inches. And these numbers, these repetitive digits, I found that repetitive digits are very important. And I've made some, recently I've started blogging on Secrets in Plain Sight, and I just made a post the other day on repeating ones. But one of the things I wanted to talk about with you today is the relationship of 6 to 5. Let's see, 6. This number 6 is something that I would say is the number of structure, because if you look at a honeycomb, it's made of these hexagons. If you take circles, like let's say coins on a table, and put them together, it automatically forms a hexagonal structure. You know, 6 fit perfectly around a central seventh. There was a hexagon found at the North Pole of Saturn by the Cassini spacecraft, which is really amazing to see this pure geometry appearing on something as large as a planet. So the things that correlate with 6 are structure, I would say the macrocosm. It's sort of a crystalline, non-living kind of number, in a sense. And then if you look at the number five, it's all about life. Because if you look at a pentagon or a pentagram, the number phi is encoded fractally within a pentagram. The phi is this number 1.618 dot, dot, dot. It goes on forever. But it's if you have a rectangle in the proportion of 1 to phi, it's called a golden rectangle. And this is something that artists and architects have used for hundreds of years. And it's been recognized that this golden rectangle is the most aesthetically pleasing rectangle. So, and our bodies are made with this number five, with this golden mean or golden proportion. The relationship of your of the first knuckle on your finger to the first and second knuckle has this sort of golden proportion, and so on. Down your hand and up your arm and so on. There are people who have written books about this. There's a book called, I think it's just called The Golden Proportion by Priya Hemingway. Very good book.
Yeah, and Jason Martineau of Wooden Books that I just mentioned, he's got one out as well on the golden section, and I don't think it's in his Quadrivium book, but the golden section is what ties or golden ratio is what ties the trivium to the quadrivium.
How so? That's really intriguing. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, it connects in through not the Fibonacci number sequence. There's another number sequence in that book. I would have to go pull it off my shelf and look at it right now to tell you specifically, but...
Well, I can look at other, you know. I'm a big fan of the Wooden Books, by the way, and John Martineau's Little Book of Coincidence.
Right, right,
it's,
yes.
It's just incredible. It's really worth reading. And
I had John on my show recently, as well as his cousin Jason Martineau on music, and then I also had Scott Olson on regarding the golden ratio recently.
Well, I've got to tune into those interviews because I'm really interested in those subjects.
Yeah, you're cutting out just a little bit there. All right, well, let's get into... Well, I wanted to talk about some of these other cities. If you wouldn't mind, why don't we talk about New York and Stonehenge and some of these other things that you found, Egypt. And then I know you had wanted to get into some new research on fives and sixes that you've just done. So, you know, why don't we cover some of the information that's in your video first and then get to your new research?
Sure. Where shall I start?
All right. Well, let's start with New York City.
Okay. The way that I researched New York City was that I was just researching Washington, D.C., and this led me to New York City because I was looking at the White House and how there's a horseshoe-shaped backyard, and I created, there's this diagram that fits over Washington, D.C., which is like a pyramid. And within that pyramid, there's different divisions. And one of them is a pair of 5, 12, 13 triangles, making a 5 by 12 rectangle that surrounds the White House. Okay? And I just happened to remember that at Stonehenge, there is a station rectangle there that has that same proportion, 5 to 12. And I thought, that's really interesting because these are Pythagorean triangles. You know, 5, 12, 13 triangles are these Pythagorean triangles. And when you put two of them together, you get this 5 to 12 rectangle. And I thought, well, that's kind of there's some kind of correlation there maybe between the White House and Stonehenge. So I just followed my intuition and I started drawing lines in Google Earth between different points in D.C. and the center of Stonehenge. And lo and behold, when I drew a line from the center of Stonehenge to the tip of the Federal Triangle, this line bisects Central Park in New York City. So I thought that was pretty amazing. So I zoomed into Central Park and took a screen capture, brought it into SketchUp, and drew some rectangles over it. And I realized that the Central Park is four 5, 12, 13 triangles. That is, it has a proportion of 5 to 24, which is really amazing, especially since this line bisects the park. It cuts right down through the park diagonally. So I thought, well, maybe there's something to that. I mean, what I'm noticing these Pythagorean triangles in Central Park seems kind of preposterous, but bear with me for a moment. Then I looked at the reservoir in Central Park and noticed that there's a line running through it. It must be like a concrete underwater structure. And I looked on all over the net and I looked at pictures of this reservoir, and none of them show this underwater structure from the surface. I guess you can only see it from space, but it's, you know, go on Google Earth and take a look. It's very pronounced. Anyway, this line is the mirror angle of the vector going from the tip of the Federal Triangle to the center of Stonehenge. And mirrors are very important in this in these patterns that I've found, because a mirror is sort of like the thing that reflects from as above to so below, the Hermetic motto. And I found even in metrology, the science of measurement, the mirror is the line that you put between the fraction, between the numerator and the denominator. It's this kind of classic Hermetic concept. So I thought, well, that's unmistakable. There's this line that is a mirror of this vector. And so then I traced that line, and if you extend it beyond the reservoir, it goes right to the Metropolitan Museum of Art. So I look at the Met, and I see that right outside the Met, there's a 3,500-year-old Egyptian obelisk. And, all this symbolism ultimately traces back to Egypt because of, these Pythagorean triangles. Pythagoras is the person that we attribute, the discovery of the Pythagorean theorem and all. But Pythagoras was trained in Heliopolis. So he got this information from the ancient Egyptians. All these patterns that I find ultimately are traced back to Egypt. So anyway, I go into the Met and I get a floor plan for it, and I overlay it over the building in Google Earth, and I make it transparent so I can see where the line is, cutting through the building, and it goes directly to the Temple of Isis. It's called the Temple of Dendur within the Sackler wing of the Met. This is an actual Egyptian temple that was moved to New York City in the late 60s when the government of Egypt was building the Aswan High Dam. They were going to flood this whole valley, and so they needed to move a few temples out, and they gave one to the United States. And the person who ceremonially received this temple was Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, and this was after JFK had been killed earlier on. But I thought that was amazing because the reservoir is called the Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis Reservoir, and in fact, she lived very close to this spot. So I thought that was amazing, this Egyptian connection. This line is like directing you right there to that temple. But then if you continue that line that starts in the reservoir and goes through the Temple of Isis in the Met, it goes straight to the United Nations headquarters, which is amazing. And the Secretariat building proportions are 1 to 5. One of the videos, I analyzed the giant mural, which is inside the Security Council chamber of the United Nations. And it's just packed with Hermetic symbolism. It has a Vesica Pisces, and inside that you have Adam and Eve and Lucifer in the tree handing Eve the apple. And it has a phoenix. It has Masonic sun and moon. It just goes on and on. It has symbolism that ties in with the French Revolution. It's really packed with secrets in plain sight, if you will. But I wanted to also tell you that I just made a discovery and made a blog post about it yesterday. that relates to this. Let me just pull that up and tell you about it. During the late 60s, I mentioned that the government of Egypt was making the Aswan Dam, and they had to get rid of a few temples. The Temple of Dendur was just one of them. There's another one called the Temple of Dibod, and that was relocated to Madrid, right next to the royal palace there in Madrid. And someone emailed me and told me I should take a look at it, so I'm checking it out. There's a reflecting pool that they put around this thing to give it the look of as above, so below, like the mirror, which is pretty cool. But I was looking at the complex in Google Earth, and it has this strange angle with respect to north. And I thought, that's interesting. I want to see if that's pointing to anything. So I drew a line right through this linear complex, and I noted the angle with the ruler tool in Google Earth, and I zoomed out and I kept extending the line, but extending at that same precise angle, and it goes directly to Rome. More specifically, it goes directly to the obelisk at the center of St. Peter's Square in the Vatican, and the line cuts right down the middle of St. Peter's Basilica, and it goes right down the middle of this Lobarum design in St. Peter's Square. It's really amazing. So obviously this Temple of Dibod was located exactly where it is as this geomantic alignment, creating this sort of talisman, if you will. And then my friend and fellow researcher Kort Lindahl had discovered some time ago that if you extend this line from the obelisk in St. Peter's Square, straight out eastward, it goes directly to the Hagia Sophia in Istanbul. And so now we have an alignment that goes from this Temple of Dibod straight to the Hagia Sophia, and it bisects the Vatican precisely right through the basilica and right through the ancient Egyptian obelisk in St. Peter's Square. And, you know, what are the chances of this? I think it's astronomical.
And it sounds like what they're doing is they're putting all of these temples on the lines of sacred geometry and the Platonic from the Platonic solids. Is that correct?
I don't know about. I don't see the connection with the Platonic solids here, but it's called a great circle. So it's not just a straight line on a map, but it's actually a great circle whose center is the center of the Earth. And this is what the path tool does in Google Earth. So it actually compensates for the curvature of the Earth, if you will. And, it's one thing to draw a line from point A to point B, but if it goes right through a point in the middle, a point C, if you will, then we're really onto something there. This reminds me of another amazing geomantic alignment that Kort Lindahl discovered. And what he does is he looks at a structure and analyzes, the form of it. So, for example, in Baalbek in Lebanon, there's this ancient platform there, and there's a hexagonal structure on top. And so what Kort does is he'll draw vectors out in six directions because it's a hexagon. And he'll see if those vectors hit anything interesting. Well, one of them goes directly to I.M. Pei's World Trade Center in Baltimore. And it goes right to this pentagonal structure there. It's like the world's tallest regular pentagon, I believe. And more than that is that this vector goes along one of the edges of this pentagon, right on the money. And it goes right through one of the vertices of the hexagon. So there's really something to that, I thought. But then I was looking at that alignment, and I discovered a third point, which sort of validates it all. and that is that the line goes directly over Silbury Hill in the UK. And so I'm sure that I.M. Pei was using geomancy there when he decided to build this pentagonal high-rise in this precise location. And that is a beautiful example of how 6 relates to 5, because of the hexagon of Baalbek and the pentagon of the World Trade Center in Baltimore. This is a good segue, I suppose, to get into some of the 6s and 5s that I found.
Sure, let's do it.
All right, so first of all, let's go back to Egypt, where I think the first example of this comes from. Just south of Giza, there's a place called Dahshur, and it's the location of the Red Pyramid and the Bent Pyramid. The Red Pyramid has a slope which is less steep than the Great Pyramid, and at world-mysteries.com, they decoded this slope angle. And it's really beautiful how it was designed, because if you take a pentagon and divide it up into 5 triangles, then those triangles are actually the exact proportion that the faces of the Red Pyramid have. And, you know, it's hard for me to describe in words, but if you look at my Egypt videos, you can see this animated, where you put these four pentagons around the Red Pyramid, and then you tilt up those triangles within them, and when they touch and form the pyramid, it's perfect. So it's really, this Red Pyramid was designed sort of as a temple to the number 5. And so that was sort of like the test case, if you will, because the Bent Pyramid, which is just south of the Red Pyramid, you can stand there and see it from one pyramid. You can just stand there and look at the next one. Well, the Bent Pyramid has 2 slope angles. One is shallower than the Great Pyramid, and one is steeper. The one that is shallower matches the slope angle of the Red Pyramid exactly. So we already know what that's all about. It's about 5. But the slope that is steeper than the Great Pyramid can be precisely created by taking a hexagon and dividing that up into 6 equilateral triangles, and then tilting that up, tilting one of those triangles up. And if you put 4 of these hexagons around the Bent Pyramid and tilt up the triangles, when they meet, it describes the lower slope of the Bent Pyramid precisely. So basically, what we have here is a temple of the relationship of 6 to 5. So that's the ancient Egyptian correlation with this ratio. But if we take 6/5, so we're doing sort of an as above, so below thing here, where we're relating the macrocosm to the microcosm. If you say 6/5 times phi squared, that equals pi. And that's pretty amazing, because it's hard to create a relationship between phi and pi. And here we've done it with this key to alchemy, if you will, this relationship between macrocosm and microcosm. And this reminds me of Albrecht Dürer, who made a drawing in something he published, which is called The Art of Measurement with Compasses and a Ruler. He drew a diagram that shows a hexagon and a pentagon sharing an edge, and they're coming out of the Vesica Pisces, which is like the mother of all forms. And so I think that's pretty key, because Albrecht Dürer was really tuned into a lot of this occult symbolism. And I go into some of the things that he was up to in my videos. But also, John Michel published this beautiful and very simple formula that describes the mean circumference of the Earth in miles. It's 6 divided by 5 times 12 to the 4th power. That is the mean circumference of the Earth in miles, if you can believe it. Do the math, and you'll see that it is true. It's really amazing. And so this is where it sort of gets mystical, because how is it that the Earth has this very simple numerical relationship to this alchemical key, 6/5? Some of the most beautiful things are simple, like E equals MC squared, or 6/5 times 12 to the 4th power, if you will. I already mentioned that the Washington Monument is 555 feet, which equals 6,660 inches, but also St. Paul's Cathedral has that same length from the first step as you enter the cathedral all the way to the end of the cathedral. And this fact was pointed out by Stephen Skinner in his book Sacred Geometry. And I've also identified that the Spinnaker Tower in Portsmouth, UK, has the same height. So this is really a key that is being encoded in certain architecture. There is a 650 foot tall sun tower planned for Treasure Island in San Francisco by the world's largest architecture firm, I believe. It's SOM, Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill. And so here we have it again, 650, these numbers. There's many other examples I can go into. Feel free just to jump in and
you know, your work and my work, while we have a very large amount of overlap, like, you know, what I presented in the Pharmacratic Inquisition, you've got a lot of stuff that I did not see at all when I wrote that, because I didn't know of the trivium and quadrivium at the time. So I'm very content to listen to you describe all of these things that you've found.
And by the way, I watched the Pharmacratic Inquisition the other night, and I was totally blown away. It's really a well-done work, and I can't even believe all of the connections with Santa Claus and Christmas ornaments and the Amanita muscaria. It's really mind-blowing.
Well, thanks. Really, I appreciate it. I think you are too, and one of these days we'll have to put our heads together on a project or something.
Sounds good, yeah, absolutely. I can tell you some more sixes and fives, if you will. There's another one that describes the sacred geometry of Jerusalem. And this was pointed out by, I believe it was a sort of a mutual thing where John Michel and Christine Roan published a book called 12 Tribe Nations, and they identified a 5-12 rectangle that is laid over the city of Jerusalem. And then Richard Heath wrote a book called Sacred Number and the Origins of Civilization, and he drew two X's inside that rectangle. And where those X's cross points out the location of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is the holiest spot in Christianity, because it's the place where Jesus was crucified and where he was entombed. And the other X goes over the probable location of Solomon's temple, where the Holy of Holies was kept. And this is a theory, because it's really hotly debated where Solomon's temple was on the Temple Mount. But I favor the theory by Asher Kaufman, which says that the Holy of Holies was under the Dome of the Tablets. And I go into this in my Jerusalem video. You can check that out. But anyway, how does this relate to 6 and 5? Well, there's two ways. The rectangle that surrounds Jerusalem is a 5-12 rectangle. And if you draw two X's inside, like Richard Heath did in Sacred Number, you can think of it as two depictions of 6-5. So there we have this number appearing again. but also in the metrology of this rectangle, it's I think it's 1728 cubits, and the cubits are 1.728 feet each. And that happens to be 6 over 5 raised to the third power. So if you take 6 fifths times 6 fifths times 6 fifths, that equals 1.728. And that is the length of this cubit. And there are 1728 cubits in the longer edge of this 5 by 12 rectangle. And so it's really mind-blowing that we have 6 over 5, you know, encoded twice in this sacred geometry. And again, this may be hard to follow in the audio, but if you look at the video, you will just see it. And it makes so much sense when you see it, because it involves your right brain as well. And you can, get a lot more out of it when you engage both halves of your brain. But there's also a hypercubit that measures the Earth. And this is 6 fifths raised to the fourth power. And there are 10 million hypercubits in the Earth's polar radius. And there are 63 million hypercubits in the Earth's meridian circumference. And these are very accurate. So how is it that the Earth can be measured in such an elegant way? My mind is still blown about that. And these facts were pointed out by John Michel in his book that he wrote with Robin Heath called The Lost Science of Measuring the Earth, which is really a must read in my opinion. So there we have some examples from metrology. And those are more for people that have a mind for numbers that can get into this mathematics a little bit. But let me give you another example that is something everyone can appreciate, and that comes from the world's most popular sport, which is football, or soccer as it's known in America. Well, if you look at a soccer ball, it is composed of hexagons and pentagons. Is it not? So we have a relationship right there between the macrocosm and the microcosm. And do you know how many of these panels there are on a soccer ball, Jan?
Let's see. Off the top of my head, I'm forgetting. No, I don't.
32, which is a Masonic number. And also, there are 11 players on each team. And this ties in with the 11-11 pattern that I've identified, and many other researchers have identified. People have written books on 11-11 and how this pattern recurs. So many sports are encoding secrets in plain sight. If you think about bowling, you have 10 pins arranged with one pin at the front, then 2 pins, then 3 pins, and then 4 pins. Well, do you know what that is? It's the Pythagorean tetractys, their most sacred diagram. And you can also, in a bowling alley, which is polished, you can see the reflection of the pins in the floor. So we have as above, so below right there. But also, baseball is a Masonic sport, if you will. If you look at the baseball field, from home plate, the field is like almost like compasses swept out the outfield in a semicircle. So you have these Masonic compasses that are open and create this field. And then if you draw a line from first base to second base to third base, you have a square. So now we have the Masonic compasses and square. And then the pitcher's mound would be where the G or the mound of Atum, where the Egyptian creator god created the universe. So we have another encoding there in plain sight. But how many people really are aware of these things? I would say very few. There's also a relationship that I read in the book Two Thirds, which is really an amazing book that I highly recommend. It was written by Myers and Percy. And one of the relationships in there is the relationship of time to space on the Earth. So if we look at the great year, which is the Earth's precessional cycle, that's, it's, what is it, 25,920 years?
Yeah, it depends on whose interpretation, but yes, roughly 25,800, thereabout.
Yeah, I think 25,800 is the number that our scientists measure now. But I think the mean number, if we were to see the whole great year, would probably be exactly 25,920 due to the sacred geometry involved. But if we take that number and we relate it to the number of nautical miles in the circumference of the Earth, which is 21,600 precisely, because that's how nautical miles are defined, you have the relationship of 6 to 5. So that's kind of amazing too. And in the book Two Thirds, the authors state that 6 is the number of all the non-living parts of the universe, and 5 is the number of all the living parts. So that sort of works pretty well, I think, as relating these numbers together. There's also Schwaller de Lubiecz, who was a sort of a modern alchemist, who wrote the book The Temple of Man in the mid-20th century. And he wrote that because he lived in Luxor, Egypt for, I think, about 15 years studying the temple there. And he did, you know, hundreds of drawings. And just one of his drawings is of an Egyptian gateway. And John Anthony West republished Schwaller de Lubiecz's diagram in his book, Serpent in the Sky. And it shows this gateway having the width of 1 and the height of 2. So that's like an octave in music. But also the relationship in the opening is 5s related to 6s. And you just have to see this diagram to see how that works. It's one of those things I can't really describe in words. But if you look at the pyramid that I identify in Washington, D.C., which I mentioned earlier, having a 5 to 12 rectangle inside of it. Well, it has many things in it. And it also has a pentagram and a cube. So the pentagram is on the top face of the cube. So there we have a relationship again between 5 and 6, because the cube depicted in isometric form is a hexagon. So I just start seeing these patterns everywhere. Once you tune into something, you start to notice it all over the place. It's like when I'm in the forest hunting for chanterelles, I can't find any. And then all of a sudden, I'll relax and I'll see one. And as soon as I see one, I notice there's 50 of them all around. How come I didn't see them before?
Right. It's funny that you should mention mushrooms, because that's how I am when I'm looking for mushrooms in Christian art. Well, all of a sudden, when you see one, you start seeing them all over the place. When I was going through ancient Christian artwork in various library archives all over the world, you spend about 8 hours finding one just really blatant, mind-blowing mushroom image. But then once you know how to spot them and where they're at, then you really begin to see them all over the place in the Christian artwork.
Exactly. And I think people use that phenomenon as a way to write it off. They say, well, if you start looking for something, you'll just see it everywhere, so it doesn't matter. But that's not true.
Oh, yeah.
You're just attuning your mind to this pattern.
Oh, well, you just want to see this stuff everywhere. That's why you see it. No, I mean, you know, you use critical thinking to verify the information that you're getting through the five senses. And when you have too many coincidences, you know, suddenly you have something there, and it's not just wishful thinking on your own part.
Exactly. And that's why I kind of go down this laundry list of 6 to 5 relationships, just to kind of show you that it's not just one item, that it's just a silly coincidence. But when you start seeing them everywhere, you really need to make a theory about why is this happening? It really is something that's happening that, you know, when you start seeing it everywhere. Well, let me tell you about the connection to mushrooms. And so I looked up DMT, dimethyltryptamine, which is the active ingredient in the psychoactive mushrooms.
Well, it's technically O-phosphoryl-4-hydroxy-N,N-dimethyltryptamine, but it does contain, it's a congener form of DMT is what it is.
Okay. Well, I don't know that much about chemistry other than the one course I took in college. But okay. I looked on Wikipedia and I noticed that the molecular diagram for DMT has a hexagon bonded to a pentagon. They're sharing one edge. And that's kind of amazing, isn't it? Because perhaps DMT is this alchemical bridge between the macrocosm and the microcosm.
Interesting.
And then I also noticed that adenine, which is one of the bases, one of the four bases used in DNA, has the same structure at the core. It has a hexagon bonded to a pentagon where they share one edge. And adenine is, so maybe DNA is part of this alchemy. And also then I found that adenosine triphosphate, which is known as ATP, it's the powerhouse of the cell. It's made by the mitochondrion. It's all where all the energy in the cell is stored. It's in this, creating this molecule, ATP. Well, it too is made from adenine, which has this 6 to 5 molecule at the core. So I don't know. I think that's pretty amazing how you can look down into the microcosm and find it. But also in the macrocosm, if you look at John Martineau's little book of coincidence,
sure.
There's one page in there that talks about a discovery made by Alex Geddes about the harmony of the planets. And this is another thing I'll have to send you some pictures to describe. But basically,
I just want to add real quick or interject real quick that for those who have Jason Martineau's Quadrivium book, that's book 6 or chapter 6 in the Quadrivium book that you're discussing.
Oh, is that, it's also in that book, huh?
Yes, it's repeated. The Quadrivium book is a combining of 6 of his individual books.
Okay, excellent. In that relationship that Alex Geddes found, I believe he says it's 1.2 something or other. And what I found was that if you say it's 6 over 5, which is 1.2, you have to, there's 3 different relationships. And each one of them is 6 over 5. But then you have to add a small error factor, if you will. It's like +8/1,000, +6/1,000, and +4/1,000 for each one of the 3 ratios. Well, then I found that that's 864. That's the number of the sun, because the sun's diameter is 864,000 miles. And so I thought this was really apropos, because here we are comparing the mean orbital radii of the planets in ratios, and the math that is used is 6/5 plus these little error factors, if you will, which relate the number of the sun. But also, if we look at the number of seconds in a day, that's 86,400 seconds. So there again, we have the numbers 8, 6, and 4. Also, this number has been encoded in ancient times and much more recently. If we look at the distance between the center of Stonehenge and the edge of Silbury Hill, that's 864,000 feet. So right here we have a problem in logic, because how could it be that people that lived 5,000 years ago were encoding the diameter of the sun in miles on the ground in feet? So that presupposes that these ancient people used the mile and the foot. And not only that, they must have had telescopes to measure the sun's diameter. They must have had surveying equipment to measure this, I think it's about 20 miles, this distance, whatever 864,000 feet it is. You divide that by 5,280 and you can find the number of miles. But that fact was pointed out by John Michel and Robin Heath in The Lost Science of Measuring the Earth. But then I discovered that the Place de la Concorde in Paris, the largest square in Paris, has an area of 86,400 square meters. So this also was no accident. It's a solar monument, a solar reference. The center of this Place de la Concorde is where they used to have the guillotine. And after the revolution, they put the obelisk from Luxor right there in the middle of the Place de la Concorde, which is also a solar symbol, of course.
So you're saying that astrotheology is real and it wasn't created by the Theosophists and Madame Blavatsky in the 1800s?
It's much older.
Oh, yes. You know, that's one of the most common attacks I hear from people is that, oh, astrotheology is all a new creation by Madame Blavatsky and the Theosophists. And no, because I have documents that are a couple thousand years old.
Yeah, exactly. It goes back to ancient times, and this knowledge has surfaced at different moments. The Corpus Hermeticum really fueled the Italian Renaissance, and it was the reintroduction of this Hermetic knowledge that had been suppressed by the Catholic Church during the Inquisition. But luckily, these documents were unearthed, and they were very interesting, and I think that they had really stimulated the artists and thinkers of the Renaissance to create fantastic works of art. I can also tell you about two other modern examples of this number of the sun.
Sure.
One is in London. There's a building there. The tallest building in London is called One Canada Square. And it is a square shaft that is topped off by a pyramid. And this was seen in the Harry Potter movie, The Order of the Phoenix. They fly by on their broomsticks in this movie right by the lit-up pyramid at night, and it really draws your attention to the fact that there's a Egyptian-style pyramid on top of this building. And I noticed in that movie, I went frame by frame, and I noticed that there's a flash of lightning that occurs, and that flash of lightning seems to hit the United Grand Lodge of England. It's the headquarters of Freemasonry in the UK. In that scene when they're flying right by this building.
Well, and which version of Harry Potter is that?
It's called The Order of the Phoenix.
Okay.
And there we have the Phoenix again. The Phoenix, the original Temple of the Phoenix was in Heliopolis, and it's where they had a Benben, which was a square shaft topped by a pyramid. The Phoenix is at the center of the mural in the UN Security Council chamber. Phoenix, Arizona is at 33 degrees north latitude. The flag of the city of San Francisco depicts a phoenix, as does the city of Atlanta, Georgia, which is a symbol of Atlantis. These things are ancient, and they're also modern. You'll find them in corporate logos and buildings that are currently under construction or in the oldest of temples. So there's clearly this undercurrent in culture of an elite that is very well aware of these things.
Right, and that should be recognized as corporate logos, as logos are their word or their logic.
That's a great point. I like that. Corporate logos. Wow. Well, the One Canada Square building originally, well, it was supposed to be 864 feet high. If you go to the Wikipedia page on there, it references that. And the architect, Cesar Pelli, had to make it a little bit shorter. It had to be reduced to 770 feet in height because it's in the flight path of the London City Airport. But nevertheless, that fact is lodged there in the record that the architect wanted it to be 864 feet high. But I also found some other interesting numbers related to that building, and that is the building has a tuned mass damper, which is like a pendulum that swings that keeps the building from swaying in the wind, and the pendulum can sway 33 centimeters. So there again, we have a Masonic 33. The 33rd degree is the highest degree. And also, strangely enough, on the Wikipedia page, it talks about this 108,000 deliveries are made to the loading dock of One Canada Square each year. And so this is an example of a number that they throw out just because of its symbolic value. I mean, who's counting the number of deliveries to the loading dock? And if they were, why would it be a round number? And if it was a round number, why would it be 108? Because 108 is the number of the moon. There are 1,080 miles in the moon's radius. And the element silver, which has always been associated with the moon, has an atomic weight of 108 grams per mole. So, and 108 is a number that I could go on for an hour about, but I'll spare you. But, there's 108 beads on a japa mala, which is a prayer necklace used by Hindus, Buddhists, and Jains. Anyway, I think the reason that they put that number there is because they always want to have sun and moon together. This reminds me of the sun tower that's planned to be built on Treasure Island in San Francisco. Its name is the Sun Tower. Well, the only bus that serves Treasure Island is Route 108. So you'll be able to ride the moon bus to the Sun Tower. How Masonic. These things must have been planned.
Yeah, and it gets to a point where once you crack the code, it's so in your face it becomes absurd.
Exactly. So, I mean, I hope I'm not boring you with this because I can see it everywhere. And I could go on and I could go on and on and on.
Yeah, I'm going to have to introduce you to a couple of friends of mine that are doing similar research as well. And I think we ought to sit down one day and put it all together and see what happens. It would be interesting.
Absolutely. I can tell you some more stuff about San Francisco now that I mentioned it.
Sure. Why don't we go on for another about 5 or 10 minutes and then we'll start wrapping it up.
Sounds good. I'm sort of at the end of my little short list about sixes and fives.
Okay,
so
great.
So I switched over to some other stuff. But the Transamerica Pyramid, which is the icon of San Francisco known worldwide, is 864 feet high. Now, if you look it up, it'll say that it's 853 feet high. And I believe this was done to tie the Transamerica Pyramid in with the Great of Egypt, of Giza. And that is because of the 11-foot difference. And I think that 11-foot difference is made up by the pyramidion and mast on top of the Transamerica Pyramid. And the 11-foot number is key. And I go into this in my Repeating Ones blog post that I made recently. But the Great Pyramid of Giza is 480 feet high, and that's 1/11th of a mile. The pyramidion on top of the Great Pyramid of Giza would have been 1 1/11 feet in height. And this fact was described by Richard Heath in Sacred Number and the Origins of Civilization. The Statue of Liberty is 111 feet, 1 inch in height, from the base of the heel to the top of the head. The Statue of Liberty has 7 rays in her crown, and the base star that she rests upon has 11 points. The proportion of the height to the base of the Great Pyramid is 7 to 11, just like 7-Eleven convenience store. So these things are encoded there in plain sight, and people have been maybe too dumbed down now with the assault on education to recognize these things.
Yeah. Oh, you know what? We had talked before the interview. You had wanted to retract your statement that you had made in your documentary about the Trivium.
I'd like to retract my my statement about the Trivium being trivial, because that's not the case. You pointed out that the word Trivium comes from the crossing of three paths, and that makes a lot of sense. I think I was coming from just my own ignorance there regarding the Trivium, because I found so many things that related to the Quadrivium, and I didn't find anything that related to the Trivium in my own personal journey, that I just thought it was trivial.
Right. But, I think that it's probably found all throughout there, and I see your the Pythagorean right-sided triangle throughout that, the 5-3-4 triangle, and the three aspect there is the Trivium in and of itself. But before you can enter into the studies of the Quadrivium, you have to have your grammar, logic, and rhetoric first.
That's definitely correct. You have to have mastered the Trivium to be able to think critically, and to be able to dive into the Quadrivium. And maybe it was my own intellectual arrogance to think that it was trivial, and I apologize for that. I found out that there's an amazing amount of information in the Trivium that you've pointed out, and I'm continually learning from your research. So kudos to you.
Well, and kudos to you as well. We've got a significant amount of overlap that we can certainly help each other build from. You on the Quadrivium and my stuff on the Trivium, and your stuff in sacred geometry, and mine on fertility and astrotheology and theogens as well. So, yeah. There's so much overlap between our two work. And certainly, when I did the Pharmacratic Inquisition documentary, I had no idea of the level of stuff that was there on the Quadrivium. And had I known, certainly my first book, Astrotheology and Shamanism, on both the Trivium and Quadrivium, I should say, that book would have been entirely different with all of these correlations. But, you can only write about what you know at a specific time.
Exactly. And we're on this journey, this process of discovery. And everyone's journey is a little bit different. You're coming from a different place with your own experiences. And you're discovering things along the way, tuning into different research as you go. And so we have to be careful not to offend other people, and to be careful with our words about things we don't understand. I think there's a tremendous amount in the seven medieval liberal arts for us all to study for the rest of our lives and never get to the bottom of it. That it's sort of like one of the keys to the mysteries. And there are many other keys, but the seven medieval liberal arts is perhaps one of the best. And we really should structure our education system back on this classical system that goes all the way back before the medieval time. I think this information is really a renaissance of Egyptian knowledge that's coming out that first came out again there at the Chartres Cathedral School. But it was really just the flowering of this Pythagorean or Egyptian knowledge or Platonic knowledge that's coming back. I think that this is an exciting time to be doing research, because a lot of other researchers are tuned into these things, and we're making, it's like an underground renaissance, if you will. This knowledge sort of opens people up, and it leads you naturally from one thing to another until, you start understanding the world you live in and exposing a lot of the lies and things that are secret. I think what we need to do is bring it all into the public domain so that people can benefit from it, not put any proprietary boundaries around the knowledge, but to share it freely somehow. What do you think about that, Jan?
I agree that we need to, the information needs to be used to empower people and not limited and further occulted, because all of this occultation of information and using it to empower ourselves rather than everybody has become the crux of the problem that we're all facing.
Exactly. Yeah. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the pharmacratic inquisition. Do you think that mushrooms are like God herself or himself?
I think that the ancients did believe that that the mushroom or entheogens in general were sort of God incarnate. It's the experience in and of itself. It's the fact that they were virgin born and not, they didn't know that mushrooms had a seed. It's that also this correlation with this, as above, so below, you have this bright red mushroom growing on the ground and the sun up above. And you talk a lot about the as above, so below themes in your own work. And so I think in many respects that the mushroom was considered, the anthropomorphism of God.
Yeah, I see it more as a bridge or a gateway to that information, or maybe an inter-kingdom communication. It's like Terence McKenna pointed out in his True Hallucinations book.
Sure.
That it was like his experience with the Strophoriad was like it was an almost like an extraterrestrial contact experience where he was in communion with another mind.
Right, right.
Like a teacher. And so you could call that God if you want, but I think it's like a mind-opening kind of education that probably was done in all like ancient cultures, where this is how they got the information. This is how they knew how to build that pyramid the way that they did, or this is how they knew where to put the obelisk or whatever.
Right. What is the single most important concept or idea that you would like listeners to take away from this interview?
To look more into the seven medieval liberal arts, to understand the importance of number and geometry, music and astronomy, to look at the quadrivium as a key to deciphering the mysteries, to take it seriously, to not just write it each little fact off as a coincidence, but to perceive the larger pattern for what it is.
Would you like to give out your website and any contact information that you would like people to have?
Yes, my website is secretsinplainsight.com. That's plain is PLAIN and sight is SIGHT. Some people, spell it as if it's a two-dimensional plane and if it's a website, but that's not right. So anyway, my website, secretsinplainsight.com, is the place to go to look at all my videos and read my blog posts. And I just ask that if you enjoy my research, I ask that you consider making a small donation. There's a button there on my website to do so.
And if you can afford to, make a large one.
Absolutely.
All right, Scott. Well, thank you so much for your time and your wonderful interview and all the work that you've done. And I'm sure that everyone through Gnostic Media that's been studying the Trivium and Quadrivium will find your work fascinating and very enlightening and furthering their own studies. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Jan. It's been great.